Radio MD.
RadioMD.com.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Here's Dr. Michael Roizen.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. We're a passionate show that helps you take control of your health and live at the highest quality. We're going to talk to Dr. Stephen Schrimpf, S-C-H-I-M-P-F-F. The book he has written, a wonderful book, Fixing the Primary Care Crisis. And we're going to find out why there is a primary care crisis, what it means for the health of America, what it means for the health of the world, and then how to fix it, because he has been not only a primary care doc, but an oncologist, and then CEO, that's the chief executive officer of the University of Maryland Medical School, and has given a lot of thought to this question about how to fix the primary care crisis. He looks a little bit like Bernie Sanders, so we'll talk to him about if he's done an imitation of that as well. We had on in the last hour, in case you're interested, Mile High and Healthy. One of the things I can tell that she brought up is don't eat the food on the plane. Eat it beforehand. Go to one of the airline clubs if you're fortunate enough to do that. It's much better there. But it clearly is made, she said, an average of 12 to 18 months for those foods that you eat in economy and even in business class when you travel across the nations. Order a special meal because those are prepared specially for you. I'm eating a little chocolate right now in honor of Valentine's Day. Chocolate is a healthy thing as long as you eat less than, if you will, 4 grams of sugar or four grams of saturated fat per hour. So take a small piece of chocolate, like I am right now, and eat it every hour. Gary Ginsberg is coming up at the next break. Gary's going to talk about Cuba's no-pesticide approach to bees. Does it work? The cow-free burger, no animal meat production. New data from England. Past pollution is still deadly. His lungs have memory. And is Zika really causing microcephaly? That is small brains. Is that virus really responsible or is something else doing this? And are we off the board on this? In any case, this is You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. And let's get to one of the stories that we're covering. What about the Pegan diet? And what is a Pegan diet? Well, it's pagan versus vegan. The Pegan, P-E-G-A-N, gives you a intermediate, and some say the best of both. I wouldn't agree with that, because what you want is healthy fats, and you don't want any red meat or any carnitine, lecithin, or egg yolk containing choline. Why not? Because those things stimulate inflammation. So the Pegan is to choose low, what would be called glycemic index fruits and vegetables. That is to have fruits and vegetables that don't have a lot of sugar or simple carbohydrates with them. Eat no dairy and eat no egg yolks, I would say. And then eat only gluten-free grains is another principle of the Pegan diet, and shun sugar. So it's a Mediterranean diet, but it's not as good as a traditional Mediterranean diet. It's a Mediterranean diet with meat, not as good because of the carnitine in meat changing the bacteria inside you. So I would say don't get hooked on this, if you will, fad, because it is just a fad. We've already talked about chocolate being good for your health. In one of the stories we did bring up in the first hour, the study out of the Mayo Clinic where they were able to target senescent cells, that is cells that weren't duplicating in the liver, in the heart, in the kidney, every place in your body, target them. And so when they stopped duplicating, they sent in a magic bullet to kill those cells. And because of that, Pretty easy to do, they say. We haven't seen it done in humans, but pretty easy to do, they say, the researchers say. And when they do that, it turns out it helps you live about 25 to 30% longer and with less, if you will, of the disabilities that come with aging. So this is the study on harvesting senescent cells may be a very, very important study. We also looked at the American teenagers are eating better. What do we mean by that? Well, this is a really interesting study because they looked at a huge number of adolescents, 5,000 of them, and they looked over time at the teenagers from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and 15 years ago compared to today's. And there was a consistent drop in the number of calories consumed among adolescents and a consistent drop in the percentage of calories consumed that were carbohydrates and an increase in the percentage that were from unsaturated fats. All of that is healthy. So hopefully our kids are getting healthier, and moms, you should feel really proud. You're doing a good job at getting them healthier food by getting them no simple carbs and a lot of healthier fats. Which fruits and vegetables? Well, we went over this also, of which fruits and vegetables were best to prevent weight gain. I'm not going to recover that, but just to say the ones that have flavonoids seem to be the best. Raspberries, cherries, blueberries, strawberries, red grapes, dark red fruits. Tea, if you will, is also rich in flavonoids, as are apples and pears. I guess I did go over it. The next story to go over is one that I want to cover, which is that vacation weight gain can lead to creeping obesity. Along with the souvenirs, there's a good chance that most of us return from vacation with some extra weight. In fact, when they've done this study, 61% of people gained weight on vacation, and the weights tended to stay home and accumulate year after year after year. So the goal is, when you go on vacation, weigh yourself beforehand, and then keep weighing yourself during the vacation. Don't let yourself get off the exercise. Don't let yourself eat healthier, richer foods. Eat lighter. And keep exercising and keep walking, you should be able to avoid that creeping obesity. One study that is really interesting, and I'm going to end this segment with it, is the CDC defended women's advice on drinking and pregnancy. The Centers of the U.S. Government Center of Disease Control and Prevention recommended that sexually active women refrain from drinking alcohol if they're not using birth control. It spurred a huge backlash from women saying they considered the suggestion insulting, severe, and impractical. But the report suggested that women who intend to get pregnant or could get pregnant do not drink alcohol. It's about half of all pregnancies in the United States are unplanned, and most women do not know they are pregnant until 4 to 6 weeks into the pregnancy. And the reason the CDC recommended this is because there's been a recent uptick in the number of children with fetal alcohol syndrome, which is the decrease in brain functioning and formation of the offspring if the woman drinks, especially during the brain formation periods of pregnancy. And alcohol in that period can be particularly risky. So the CDC said we want to make sure people are aware. What they do with that information is, of course, open to them. And the CDC further said, we absolutely respect women. This is not to say that we don't respect women, but it is to say we want to make sure they have the power to do what is best for them and their child. You've been listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on Radio MD. Stay well, and we'll be right back with Dr. Gary Ginsberg, my favorite segment.
The all-important family meal. Dinner just got happier and healthier. Why? Because kids are begging for crunchy, out-of-this-world, yummy, healthy veggie fries. Yep, they're healthy because they're made with real vegetables. You can choose from broccoli or carrot, chickpea and red pepper, or kale and Tuscan bean, or choose all four. Veggie fries are gluten-free, a good source of fiber, and an excellent source of vitamin A, C, and K. Plus, they're very low in sodium. Veggie fries are a parent's dream for their family. Hey, and parents love them too. So if you want to hear more veggies, please, at your dinner table, look for them in the freezer section of your favorite supermarket or natural food store. For more about veggie fries, please go to eatveggiefries.com. Veggie fries.
Did you know your eyes have hidden connections to your overall health? The Eye Care Revolution, an easy-to-read analysis of vision and health by Dr. Robert Abel Jr., is an authoritative guide that explains natural and conventional methods to prevent and even reverse many common vision disorders like cataracts, glaucoma, dry eye, macular degeneration, and diabetes-related vision loss. From high-tech laser treatments to centuries-old Asian remedies, the Eye Care Revolution, with a foreword by Dr. Mehmet Oz, provides amazing nutritional, herbal, homeopathic, and conventional methods to improve your eye health and overall health and wellness. Dr. Abel shares breakthrough information about eye strain, new developments in LASIK surgery, discusses how computers and texting are affecting our eyes, what you need to know about your children's eyes, the easy way to administer eye drops, antioxidant must-haves for your eyes, alternative therapies, and so much more. Order The Eye Care Revolution by Dr. Robert Abel Jr. on Amazon.com. That's The Eye Care Revolution. Fact: all probiotic bacteria strains are not created equal, and Natron is the only brand that cultures its own strains in-house for unparalleled quality and potency. The reasons why this makes Natron's Healthy Trinity the world's best triple-strain probiotic are endless, so we let our satisfied customers do the talking.
Hi, I'm Shirley from Lomita, California. I heard a commercial on the radio about Natron Healthy Trinity, so I called. Before that, I had gone to 3 gastroenterologists, and nothing helped me. As soon as I tried Natron Healthy Trinity, everything changed, and within 2 weeks, I experienced complete relief. I'm so pleased with your product, and I'll be taking it the rest of my life. Thank you so much.
For a limited time, you can try Healthy Trinity risk-free for 90 days. Plus, the first 20 orders get free second-day express delivery. So call toll-free right now. 1-866-4-NATREN. That's 1-866-4, N-A-T-R-E-N. Or visit natron.com and enter promo code RADIOMD. That's natron.com, promo code RADIOMD. More than half of all Americans, including teenagers, don't drink enough water. Waterlogged is a great app that will help you build good water habits with customized tracking and personalized reminders. Download Waterlogged from the iTunes App Store and start using your iPhone, iPod Touch, and iPad to track and improve your water intake. Set your goals, record your consumption, and get Waterlogged's exclusive smart reminders to alert you when you're behind pace to meet your daily goal and when it's time to hydrate. Optimal water intake is a goal that you can successfully achieve, and it'll make a measurable impact on how you feel and your overall health, because every system in your body depends on water. People who use reminders are 5 times more likely to reach their goals consistently, so let Waterlogged help you stay on track. Waterlogged is compatible with Apple Health and Fitbit, so you can log your water with the best app in the App Store and get a full picture of your health in your favorite app. Download Waterlogged from the App Store or visit waterlogged.com.
And now, back to you, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Dr. Michael Roizen.
And this is my favorite segment every day. It's with every week that we have it. Obviously, it's with Gary Ginsberg. What'sToxic.com is his website. And Gary, Cuba does not use pesticides relating to controlling fruits and vegetables. Is that right? And consequently, they have better bee fertilization?
So we've talked before about colony collapse disorder, basically the syndrome that has hit bees pretty much around the world that has cut down on their populations, which is affecting our ability to grow crops. So this has huge feed the world kind of implications. If you don't have pollinators, you don't have agriculture, essentially. And We have now an experiment going on in Europe where they've cut back on a certain class of pesticides called the neonicotinoids, which are pesticides and affect the nervous system of the pest insects they're trying to get rid of, but also apparently mess with the honeybees' nervous system in a way that makes them leave the hive and collapse the hive. So that's the colony collapse disorder syndrome connection to the neonics. Well, Cuba has been having a honey industry for a long time, along with, of course, cigars and rum. And since the collapse of the Soviet Union, which had been propping up Cuba up until about the early 90s, they stopped using pesticides. They just don't have the economic wherewithal in Cuba to use a lot of pesticides. So they've been switching over to more and more organic methods, and they've been growing organic honey and a lot of organic agriculture that's pesticide-free. And guess what? The bee populations are fine in Cuba. So here we have an experimental, a natural experiment, which is sort of proving that the neonicotinoids or some version of pesticide is affecting the health of bee populations theoretically around the world. Now, the experiment in Europe is about 2 years old, and they think they're seeing an improvement in the bee populations there from the cutback on pesticides. Neonicotinoids are a huge market player. They are very commonly used here in the United States. So the impact on agriculture would be quite significant if we favor bees over what these pesticides do for other aspects of farming. So it's all very interesting as playing out. But you can buy organic, because of the embargo being lifted against Cuba, you can buy organic honey from Cuba. I don't think it's going to convert you to their way of thinking, so don't worry about that part. And, you know, just know that you're getting, you know that you're getting organic honey from a place not using pesticides.
Now, can we avoid neonicotinamides without any problem? It seems like Europe and Cuba are doing them, but they obviously have different other things. Is it possible to avoid them?
Sure, yeah, but, you know, not without some retooling of our agricultural practices. Maybe some other chemicals could be used to hold down pests. But, you know, what we have looked at is, for now, for the last 25 years, is something called IPM, or Integrated Pest Management, where not just for farmers, but also for backyard gardeners, to try to monitor where you're getting, so not just prophylactically spray and use a lot of chemical where you don't need it, but just very selectively, minimalist approach to using pesticides. Maybe you could still use some neonicotinoids in sparing situations, but, you know, really keeping an eye on the non-target organisms like the bees and trying to, you know, have a win-win. Right now, you know, agricultural practices, all you've got the magic, you got the magic bullet, and use it and zap the enemy and keep things under control, nice and tidy, zip zap. But that isn't always the kindest thing to do for the rest of the environment, which we actually do need to have agriculture in whole.
Pretty cool. Now, so they've done it, we should be able to do it. Talk to me about the other story there are four stories, obviously, that I want to get to, but one of that's most interesting is microencephalopathy and Zika, and the statement from Colombia that maybe Zika there is like the old Zika in Africa that didn't cause the problem.
Right.
Tell us about it.
Well, so it's the Colombian president, Juan Manuel Santos, and so he's not a scientist. Hopefully he is speaking the truth from his doctors and scientists, but, you know, he is not necessarily the most scientific authoritative source. But he is saying that in Colombia, over the past series of months, they've had 3,177, over 3,000 women, pregnant women, get infected by the Zika virus, and they have zero cases of microcephaly. They have about 25,000 people overall with recorded cases. They've had three people die from the Zika virus, so they obviously have a robust outbreak of it, but they claim they've got no microcephaly. So the explanation is either they're not looking hard enough, or they actually don't have any, and this strain that they've got is different than the Brazilian strain, because in Brazil they do see an association. So, or what they're seeing in Brazil is just chance and not actual, it's just a chance association and not actual cause and effect. So, I think CDC and everybody is still really wants to get to the bottom of it. This is a very interesting new story. Part of the story that will be heavily investigated, I believe CDC is sending people to Colombia to see what they're talking about.
Huh. That's strange. So now the Zika beforehand, that is when it was in Africa, wasn't associated with this. How good is the data? I just saw the data on the CDC website, which said that it looks more and more likely that Zika was a cause of this in Brazil. Is that possible that it is different in different countries?
I think it's possible that you've got different strains in different countries, for sure. Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. But I also don't think that they've got, you know, absolute proof from Brazil either. They've had an association. They found the virus in across the placenta in babies that have had problems. So it looks like it, but we still don't have absolute proof, which I've said before on the show. And this Colombian thing now, just really, it's another question mark in the whole epidemiological story. And that's what makes epidemiology so interesting and exciting, is that it takes many aspects of science to figure out what's really going on.
Now, let's talk about the data from England on lungs having memory with past pollution.
Yeah, so this is a huge study. 369,000 people, the health of 369,000 people in England and Wales that have been tracked since 1971. And so some of these people were children at the time. So, you know, you've got a couple of different things, you know, early life exposures versus later life exposures may be more effective in terms of causing problems. But anyway, the data shows that the more recent your exposure to air pollution, the more effective that is, the more toxic that is. However, there is still a very clear signal that what you were exposed to 40 years ago, back in the early 70s, still has a lingering, still has an association, a lingering effect on your cardiovascular health today. So that whatever damage or whatever epigenetic effects that may have been caused, or even in utero exposure that may have caused, still can be traced to your vitality and your health today. So cigarette smoking, we know that the risk doesn't totally go away, but it's better if you stop smoking. Better if we're exposed to less air pollution, but the risk doesn't totally go away, is what this
is. And that's Gary Ginsberg on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. His website, whatstoxic.com. Great stories. Thanks very much on You. Stay well.
In today's day and age, it's refreshing to find a company with values that match yours. And it's even more extraordinary when the products they make exceed your expectation in every way. That's what Michael's Naturopathic Programs has done for over 30 years. With more than 50 tried and truthful high-potency formulas, Michael's Naturopathic Programs give your body what it needs. No more guessing what herbs or vitamin, amino acid, or mineral you need. With Michael's, it's all in one bottle. From cardiovascular support to weight management to nervous system support to detox and cleansing and more. Michael's Naturopathic Programs work. They have to. Michael himself has been giving them to his family from the very start. You can find Michael's products at your local health food store, your favorite online retailers, or visit michaelshealth.com and get your tried and truthful formulation today. That's M-I-C-H-A-E-L-S health.com.
What if you got rewarded for every good decision? What if your heart had a special way of letting you know it appreciates your healthy choices?
Oh, I've got to get my family to eat more vegetables.
Amazing!
And instead of cooking with butter tonight, I think I'll saute our veggies with a heart-healthy oil.
You're a genius!
So really, would your food choices pay off in heart health? Did you know that when you replace bad fats with healthier fats, like those in canola or other vegetable oils, it can lower bad cholesterol levels, and that's good for your heart. Here's a winning idea. Take up the challenge for good health, because the you of the future will say,
fantastic!
Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info proudly supports the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Radio ND.
Melanie Cole's Health Radio.
What does the word organic really mean?
So organic really means there's a lot of human labor put into the food that you're consuming. So it could mean there's no pesticides that are applied to seeds and to plants. There's no antibiotics or growth hormones, that are being used in animal products. And it also, in most cases, means that there's no GMO seed that's being used.
Become a healthier you 5 days a week.
What's GMO? What does non-GMO mean?
Okay, so GMO, this is a good one. So GMO stands for genetically modified organism. So the question is whether or not a seed or plant has some genetically modified gene in it.
It's health delivered daily. Listen live every Monday through Friday at noon Eastern on RadioMD.com, iHeartRadio, or the free TuneIn Radio app.
Today, you brushed your teeth. You skipped the floss. You combed your hair. You took the train. You did the crossword. You missed 22 across. You went to work. You had a meeting. You ate your lunch. You had another meeting. You wondered, how is anyone supposed to get any work done around here with so many meetings? You left the office. You took the train. You ate your dinner. You brushed your teeth. You did all the things that one normally does the day before a brutal EF5 tornado rips through town, leaving 30,000 people without power. You never know when the day before is the day before. Prepare for tomorrow at ready.gov/today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
RadioMD.com.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show with Michael Roizen, MD. Here's Dr. Mike.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on RadioMD, where our goal is, like RadioMD's, to help you stay well by taking control of your health with all the knowledge you need. And one of our guests, the guest right now, Dr. Stephen C. Schrimpf, S-C-H-I-M-P-F-F, whose website is medicalmegatrends.com, has a lot of information that can help all of us about the primary care doctor. So let's talk to Stephen. Stephen, who is the primary care doctor? Who should be our primary care doctor, and why is there a primary care crisis?
Well, maybe we should start with, when I talk to folks in the community where I live, I say, how do you define primary care? They say, oh, well, that's for the simple stuff. You know, if I get a headache that doesn't go away, or if I've got a urinary tract infection or a sprained ankle, then I go to the primary care doc. And sometimes I might call him or her, if I need to get a referral to a specialist. And, of course, that's correct, but I think that's hardly cutting the surface, because really comprehensive primary care, which is what we should all get, really starts with wellness and health maintenance. Maybe that's the most important thing. And sure, it takes care of these day-to-day things that come up in our life, like the ones I mentioned. But particularly important is taking care of complex chronic illnesses. And it seems like more and more Americans are developing those, things like, you know, heart failure, diabetes with complications, chronic lung disease, and so on. And we sometimes think, well, the primary care doc can't take care of that. But the fact is they can. They've been very well educated, very well trained, and they enjoy it. Problem is they don't have enough time. And that's the crisis, not enough time. And so if you don't have enough time, and it seems like more and more visits to the primary care doctor are about 15 minutes, which means what I call FaceTime, you know, you and me interacting together is maybe 8 to 10 minutes, maybe 12. And again, that's okay for that simple stuff, but it's not okay if you're that elderly individual who, say, has 3 or 4 chronic illnesses on 5 to 7 prescription medications, maybe has some visual or hearing impairment, maybe a little cognitive impairment. 10 to 12 minutes just doesn't do it. It's also not enough time for the person, and these are a large percentage of folks who come in, with anxiety as an underlying, you know, predisposing factor to whatever the apparent medical problem is. They need more time. And just time for what I'll call building that relationship.
Let's go back a little bit. Who should be your primary care doctor? Can you use a gynecologist? Can you use a pediatrician? Can you use obviously an internist? What about a nurse practitioner? Who should fit the role of primary care provider? And how is that different in the new environment of these retail clinics and stuff like that?
Okay, I think you've asked about 7 questions at once, so let me try and take a couple of them. Someone who's trained in primary care, and that can be an internist who's taken a 3 or more year residency in primary care. It can be a pediatrician. Of course, pediatricians are going to focus on kids. It can be a family medicine physician whose training is both adults and children. A gynecologist, perhaps, if, in fact, they have that broad experience and not just the gynecology experience, if you will. And the issue about nurse practitioners, I think, is somewhat controversial, but I think that many nurse practitioners are quite competent and can do the job. Personally, I think it's best when a physician and a nurse practitioner work together as a team.
One of the things you talked about was the lack of time. I think this actually started in our early youth when Medicare, when we accepted less time, less payment for Medicare patients in primary care, and consequently we cross-subsidized it from other insurance companies. We were being paid more in those days from others as a percent, and consequently could spend more time. But as we accepted less, and then we had a few bad apples. There were people who would do a 2-minute primary care visit, and consequently would churn a lot of patients, and Medicare said, well, if they can do it, everyone can do it, and we'll lower the reimbursement. So there got to be a lower reimbursement for these, what we call primary care visits, and so physicians couldn't do it in that time, and with their office overhead, et cetera, so they adjusted to the lower reimbursement, not only from Medicare, but then the others lowered it. Does that play a role, or am I mistaken, Steve?
No, I think you're right on. You've got what I'm going to call price controls by Medicare, and then, of course, the commercial insurers did the same thing. And then at the same time, you mentioned overheads. Overheads have been going up faster than reimbursements have been going up. And overheads, of course, are, you know, the office expense for heat, light, rent, and so on, the nurse, the receptionist. But also overheads have been going up because doctors now need a lot of people to deal with billing issues. It's so complicated now. And you've got to have help with the electronic medical record. You've got to have help with these quality indicators that the insurers want. So all these things take more time, and it takes time away from the patient. As I talk to primary care physicians, well, I'm told by those who've been in practice for a good length of time, they tell me that they're seeing twice as many patients today, usually around 24 to 30, than they used to, yet they're being paid the same amount, adjusted for inflation. So their pay is the same, but they're seeing twice as many patients to do it. And if you're seeing 24 or 25 patients a day, the math says that's a 20-minute visit. And, of course, that isn't, because you still have to have time to make a phone call, read a report, do this and that. So the visit ends up becoming 15 minutes, and as we said before, just a little bit of face time. There's just not enough
time. In fact, the electronic medical record, one of the things that it has done is allow the insurance companies to look at the records closer, which means you have to fill out more things that may be obvious. So you have to check the medications that you've done in the past. You've already done that usually. You also have to check their allergies and do a bunch of, every time you see a patient, you got to do a depression screen now. And all of those things take a little time and a few clicks. And you say a few clicks doesn't take long. No, but when you add it up, it's like we're spending probably 7 or 8 minutes extra on the medical record for each patient. It makes us better. It makes the information better. It transmits the prescriptions better. But it is putting an extra burden on the physician or primary care provider.
Yes, that's certainly true. And it's hard to find a primary care physician who will tell you they like the electronic medical record. And they talk of this concept of meaningful use as the great oxymoron of the century.
I'm going to be different then, because I love the electronic medical record. It does take extra time, but it gives you so much more information long term. I mean, I can look at every visit my patient has had, whether they're here or whether they're in San Francisco or whether they've been seen in an emergency room. That's now all getting integrated, so it's really great information, much better knowledge. We'll be
absolutely
right back. We'll be right back with Stephen Schrimpf, S-C-H-I-M-P-F-F, Fixing the Primary Care Crisis, Reclaiming the Patient-Physician Relationship, and Returning Healthcare Decisions to You and Your Doctor. We're going to talk about how to select one when we come back on You, the Owner's Manual radio show. This is the show that lets you know how to take control of your health so you can live at the top of your curve forever. We'll be right back on Radio MD. Stay well.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Michael Roizen, MD.
RadioMD.com.
Here's Dr. Mike.
And this is Dr. Mike. We're here with Stephen Schrimpf, the author of the book Fixing the Primary Care Crisis, Reclaiming the Patient-Physician Relationship, and Returning Healthcare Decisions to You and Your Doctor. He's also the proprietor, if you will, of the Medical Megatrends, one word, or they're joined, .com website. And a brilliant doctor, started out in primary care, went to oncology. A lot of the current protocols were, the forerunners were developed by Dr. Schrimpf, and then became the CEO at the University of Maryland Medical Center, a great trauma center, as well as a resource in Baltimore, Maryland. And one of the things that we got asked, Stephen, on the questions was, my doctor is going to concierge care and wants anyone who wants to stay with him to pay a $2,000, if you will, fee for access, which gives me 24/7 access to his phone and gives me some extra privileges for referrals and being seen immediately and some extra tests and extra time with him. What do you think of this type of practice? Is it just gouging?
No, it's not. And maybe we should just go back for a second and say that there are a number of different terms that get used, and among them are direct primary care, membership care, retainer-based, and concierge. Concierge started out, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago as being really high-end and really expensive, and so it's gotten sort of a bad name. So maybe we almost ought to put that term aside and use some of the others. But the idea, direct primary care, the word direct means, I'm going to get rid of insurance for the reasons we were talking about before and let the patient pay the physician directly out of pocket. And frankly, it's the way I was brought up, and I know that's how we paid our pediatrician when our daughter was born and growing up, but we've gotten away from that. Anyway, the idea is you pay the physician directly, and here's what the doctor does in return. Instead of having 2,500 or 3,000 or more patients, they reduce the patient number down to around 500. Different docs do different numbers, but around 500. When you have that fewer patients, then you can say to your patients, if you call, I will see you today or certainly tomorrow. I'll give you as much time as you need, none of this, 15-minute stuff, and we'll take a lot of time on wellness, on health promotion, on care coordination, and I'll be able to take care of most of the things that come up with regard to chronic illnesses. I'll give you my cell phone number, I'll respond to emails, which most docs won't do, as you know. And so that's kind of the package. Some add on some things to that, and they say, I'll give a sort of an annual battery of blood tests, and I'll add in some other things like spirometry, vision test, hearing test. So it's pretty comprehensive. And then not all for sure, but many, an increasing number, go and buy generic medications, the most common medications that get used that are generic, and they sell these off to the patient for what they paid for them. There's no markup, and it's a huge savings. And then likewise, they'll go to the local radiology center, in the local laboratory center, and say, if I pay you with cash on the barrel head here, give my patients a big break. And the break is amazing. It's just amazing how much it comes down. Anyway, that's direct primary care. And as I say, it has a couple different names. Some do charge as much as $2,000. Others charge, if they do it by the month, sometimes like around, say, $40 for somebody in a younger age range, a younger adult, maybe $75 a month for an older adult, which is really sort of a proxy for you. Well, you probably have more illnesses, you're going to want to see me more often, and maybe much less for a child, maybe $10 a month. So it can actually be, if you will, blue-collar, a blue-collar rate. Probably won't find that in Manhattan. But you will find it in smaller communities around the country.
And what you're saying is there is a value to this. And how do you very well in the book detail the difference? I think you give the example of Starbucks, as I remember it in the book. Or what is medical care worth to you, and how do you decide how much to spend on what?
Yeah, I've got I'm calling you on a landline right now, but I've got a smartphone in my pocket, and if I tell you how much I pay for that per month compared to what, a direct primary care physician might charge, turns out they're pretty equivalent. So it's sort of a prioritization of what's most important to you. And I'm not going to say this is right for everybody. It probably isn't. It turns out, though, as more and more people are, getting bronze-type plans with high deductibles, or their employer makes them take a high deductible or pushes them toward a high deductible, if you're going to have a high deductible, it means you're going to pay the primary care doc out of pocket anyway. So why not go to somebody who will give you the time you need, and you're not going to be paying any more? I think it's the right way to go.
We have a guest, we have a question on the line. Jim Graham, Mr. Graham.
Yes,
from
Dr.
upstate
Mike.
New York. Yes. Go ahead and ask Mr. Schimpfer, Dr. Schimpfer, the question, would you?
All right, Dr. Schimpf, thanks for taking my call. And
sure.
You and Dr. Mike just blew up my question on insurance because I saw you want to kind of do away with it. But what I'd like, and first of all, you have to understand that I'm an old guy, and I remember going to the doctor's office and paying the doctor with no insurance and all this stuff. But what's going on in hospitals now, here in Oswego at least, our primary care doctor is not allowed in the hospital to treat a patient. For example, if my wife or my late wife or myself was to be admitted for pneumonia or flu or something like that, we'd be treated by a hospitalist. So now, in essence, I think it says it on the cover of your book, reclaiming a patient's relationship with you and your doctor, that's saying get the government out of it, right? What's going on with these hospitals now rather than your primary care doctor coming in?
Yeah, so it's a sort of a complex thing. There's a lot of value to the hospitalist concept because they work in the hospital all the time. They don't know how to deal with the hospital and the issues that come up in the hospital. And it allows the primary care doc to do more of what they're maybe best at in their office. But, and you just brought up all the buts, one is communication. Is there good communication between doctor, primary care doc, and hospitalist? And often there is not. And so there's a big advantage of having the primary care physician go into the hospital and see you every day. Sure, the hospitalist is there too, but the primary care doc is there every day. And that's what
we're going to have to cut it off. We've run out of time. Dr. Schimpf, medicalmegatrends.com is where you can get him.